From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham, in for Cynthia Canty. Today, the American Civil Liberties Union versus the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops. The ACLU says the issue is whether women are getting appropriate medical care at Catholic hospitals.
What happens when you have the best interest of the patient being trumped by somebody else's religious beliefs?
Then we'll talk with a member of the American Studies Association about that group's boycott of Israeli academic institutions.
Although it is called an academic and cultural boycott, it isn't really a boycott. It's a statement against the Israeli occupation of Palestine.
And new music for the new year, from Ghana to New Orleans to Detroit.
The thing that I was really hoping for was that connection with Detroit, with Michigan jazz as well as New Orleans jazz.
Those stories and more on Stateside. Welcome to the first Stateside of the new year. I'm Lester Graham, in for Cynthia Canty. 2014 might be the year for immigration reform. At least that's what supporters hope. Today we look at another issue within our immigration laws, the H-4 visa. Among some, it's called the depression visa. We'll find out just what the H-4 visa is, and we'll talk to a woman trying to change it. Then later in the hour, we'll groove to a unique blend of musical talents from Ghana, New Orleans, and Detroit. But first, the American Civil Liberties Union is suing the United States Conference for Catholic Bishops on behalf of a Michigan woman. At the heart of the issue is whether women can get appropriate medical care at a Catholic hospital. This is becoming more important because more secular hospitals are merging with Catholic-affiliated healthcare providers. By our count, of the 187 hospitals in Michigan, 26 of them are Catholic. That's 14%. Joining us now are Carrie Moss, the Executive Director of the American Civil Liberties Union of Michigan, and Dr. Lori Friedman. She's an assistant professor in medical sociology at the University of California, San Francisco. Carrie Moss, let's start with the case in Michigan that led to this lawsuit. What happened?
Well, a young mother came to us some time ago and told us a story that she had been pregnant and gone to Mercy Health Hospital in Muskegon, Michigan. It's the only hospital for about 30 miles around her. It's affiliated, as a Catholic hospital. She was 18 weeks pregnant and her water had broken. So she went for medical care. The hospital told her that they couldn't do anything to help her. They sent her home. She returned the next day. She was bleeding. She was cramping. They sent her home again. Again, they did not tell her about what any of her options were. She returned a third time, and then at that point, she kind of went into labor, and she was taken care of. But at that point, she already had a significant infection. We decided to represent her and to file this lawsuit naming the Catholic bishops and charging them with negligence because she did not receive basic information about what healthcare options were in her best interest.
Let me stop you there. So why not sue the hospital? Why sue the bishops?
Because this case is not about one person or one hospital. The challenge here is that there are these medical ethical directives that the bishops have written that govern practices in Catholic hospitals and supersede what is really should be done oftentimes in the best interest of the patient. And we believe that her case really kind of epitomizes something that is happening nationwide to women who are, you know, pregnant and suffering and not getting the best treatment they should.
What are these issues concerning the ethical and religious directives the bishops require Catholic hospitals to follow?
The ethical directives prohibit abortion, and those are interpreted presumably pretty broadly. And in cases like this, where a woman is actually in the throes of a miscarriage, they're being interpreted so broadly as to prevent her from getting basic health care that's in her best interests.
Lori Friedman, how have we seen the U.S. bishops' directives impact patient care across the United States? Is this commonplace?
Yes, I do research with mostly OBGYNs in the United States about their experiences trying to deliver obstetric care in Catholic hospitals, and the ethical and religious directives for healthcare services are standard. They're attached and part of the contract of doctors nationally who are working in Catholic hospitals. So pretty much any doctor I've talked to is aware of the basics of the directives, restrictions around abortion, and usually other related reproductive services.
Well, Dr. Friedman, why can't people who are concerned about these religious doctrines implemented by Catholic hospitals just go to hospitals which are not affiliated with Catholic health care?
Well, like in the case of Timi Shamin, she didn't really have another option for care nearby. That's common. There are a number of sole provider hospitals that are Catholic. I think it's the last statistic I saw was something like 8 to 10%. So sole provider hospitals are hospitals designated as the only one near a certain population in the area. And so every,
So there might be one hospital in a county or serving several counties, and it just happens to be affiliated with Catholics.
So some patients just won't have a choice about care. But then you have to look at the other fact that some patients will have no idea how this could affect their care and not be concerned that the awareness that patients have about the directives, I think, is probably pretty low and probably merits research.
Carrie, how much of a problem is this going to be to get by the federal courts? I mean, this is tough. You're talking about religious liberties here.
Well, nobody, and the ACLU is certainly not telling the bishops what to believe. What we are saying is that these directives cannot trump medical practices that are, need to be taken in the best interest of women's health. And in this case, Ms. Means was never told the truth about her situation. She was never told that her fetus had little chance of surviving, that by attempting to continue the pregnancy, she was putting her own health at risk, or that completing the miscarriage was the safest approach for a woman in her condition. And so we really have here not religious freedom as the issue, but what happens when you have the best interests of the patient being trumped by somebody else's religious beliefs.
This is something that's come up before. There was a nun who was an administrator of a Catholic hospital who ended up being excommunicated because she interpreted the directives by the Catholic bishops differently. This is something that we've been talking about but skirting around for some time. Why do this now? Haven't there been cases like this in the past?
Certainly. I think this is happening much more than people believe. I mean, many women in this position are traumatized by it. They're afraid to come forward. They don't realize that anything wrong was done to them. But I mean, the reason we got involved was because this woman came to us, specifically asking for help. So it became a case that was important to bring to the public's attention and certainly to bring to the court's attention.
Dr. Friedman, do we know if the doctors and other staff members of these hospitals generally agree with the religious doctrine as laid out by the bishops? I mean, how does this complicate the issue?
What we know about how doctors feel, I've seen research that shows that 52% of OBGYNs in the United States have some kind of objections to the religious policies of their own Catholic hospitals. So that's telling us about roughly half of the doctors are not comfortable with all the policies. And I also know that the doctors that work in Catholic hospitals are about the same sort of religious breakdown as any other hospital. There's the same number of, Catholic, non-Catholic Christian, Jewish, Hindu. So we're really, Catholic hospitals have grown to such a point that they're hiring and serving kind of the same population as any other hospital. They don't necessarily have the same belief systems. And the doctors that I talk to in my qualitative research certainly have objections to some of the miscarriage management restrictions and some of the abortion restrictions, some of the sterilization restrictions, and they find ways to work around them or else they become very frustrated. I kind of hear about all the different scenarios.
So what's going to be the answer here to solve the problem? Is it a matter of Catholic hospitals handing out a pamphlet saying, here's the advice you will get, and here's the advice we will not give you in these cases, or do you want something more?
Well, women certainly have a right to know what their medical options are. So that at the end of the day has to be the bottom line, that they are given complete, accurate medical information so that they can make informed decisions.
Anything beyond that?
That would be a good start.
Okay. Carrie Moss is the executive director of the American Civil Liberties Union of Michigan, and Dr. Lori Friedman is an assistant professor in medical sociology at the University of California, San Francisco, talking about the ACLU lawsuit against the United States Conference for Catholic Bishops on behalf of a Michigan woman. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Lester.
Thank you.
This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham, sitting in for Cynthia Canty. Members of the academic group American Studies Association have voted to boycott Israeli academic institutions. It's to protest Israeli human rights violations against Palestinians. Basically, the boycott means members of the association will not collaborate with Israeli schools, but they can work with Israeli scholars. To say this boycott is controversial might be a bit of an understatement. As with any issue dealing with Israel and Palestine, people have very strong opinions. Joining us now is a member of the American Studies Association, Anna Pegler-Gordon. She is an associate professor at Michigan State University. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
I want to talk about the logic just for a second. So how will refusing to work with Israeli schools accomplish establishing a dialogue about the human rights violations against Palestinians?
I think it's a symbolic move. There is no enforcement mechanism. There is a recognition that some individuals in the American Studies Association and in Israeli institutions are involved in a dialogue around Israel's occupation of Palestine. But my understanding is really that the purpose of the boycott is not to facilitate that dialogue, but in fact is simply sort of symbolically to protest it by instituting a boycott.
I think a lot of the academics involved in this discussion are saying, well, why Israel? There are many countries which violate human rights of others, and why now? I mean, this is a struggle that's been going on for more than a half a century.
I personally agree. I don't believe that Israel should be singled out in this way. I feel that, you know, it's inappropriate to single Israel out, especially when there are many more academic freedoms for many more people in both Israel and Palestine than there are in many other countries.
Of course, the point of Israeli attacks sometimes shut down Palestinian schools. And so forth. I mean, do you see the point of the supporters of this boycott?
A lot of supporters argue that because Palestinian academic freedoms are violated, therefore it's a good idea to limit Israeli and American academics' academic freedom a little bit because Palestinians' academic freedoms are violated extensively. I disagree with that logic. I think that there are many more creative ways to protest Israel's occupation of Palestine and the violation of Palestinians' academic freedoms than an academic and cultural boycott. But the argument that some scholars make in support of this is that there's an asymmetry between how Palestinians' academic freedoms are violated, which is, I would agree, much more extensive than the impact this will have on Israeli scholars and American scholars.
You oppose the boycott, but you're part of the American Studies Association and the Association for Asian American Studies. Both of those groups are boycotting. How will you encourage them to end it, and how will they know when to lift the boycott?
There was no discussion at the American Studies Association annual meeting about the potential of lifting the boycott. I think this shows that it is really a symbolic move rather than a practical boycott. And frankly, I plan to travel to Israel, and if I receive funding from an organization that's supported by the Israeli government, I plan to continue to travel to Israel. I teach American studies and Asian American studies, but as part of my practice, I also teach about global issues in citizenship and immigration, and those issues are very relevant to Israel and to Palestine. So there are There's financial support for scholars to travel to learn more about issues of citizenship, immigration, race, and identity in Israel and in Palestine. And I plan to take advantage of those opportunities, and I don't believe that I will face any repercussions for that because this is an advisory boycott.
The point is, some members like you will be ignoring the boycott. I'm just wondering if there's some kind of sanction from either of these academic groups that you can expect, or is that the end of it?
There is no sanction mechanism in the boycott. This is partly what I don't, although it is called an academic and cultural boycott, it isn't really a boycott. It's a statement against the Israeli occupation of Palestine. But a boycott has to have some kind of sanction mechanism, and this doesn't have a sanction mechanism. I think it's called a boycott to make it sound more controversial, to get more attention for the boycott movement. But I think if it were a real boycott with real sanction mechanisms, it wouldn't have passed the American Studies Association.
We've been speaking with Anna Pegler-Gordon. She's an associate professor at Michigan State University and a member of the American Studies Association, as well as the Association for Asian American Studies. Both groups have passed boycotts against Israeli schools to protest Israeli human rights violations against Palestinians. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Meanwhile, the University of Michigan's president and chief academic officers have condemned the moves to boycott Israeli universities. U of M President Mary Sue Coleman and Provost Martha Pollack say in a statement that, quote, academic boycotts violate the principles of academic freedom and freedom of speech, which are fundamental to our missions of education and research, end quote. They say, again, the university is committed to continuing and strengthening its ties with Israeli universities.
When it comes to kindness, when it comes to patience, when it comes to beauty, I think of Ghana.
You're hearing a unique blend of musical talents from Ghana, New Orleans, and a little bit of Detroit. The song is Ghana from the CD entitled Payday from the band A L'Afrique. And you're going to have to excuse my French because it's terrible, but that's the best I can do. Joining me are two of the musicians behind the effort, Mark Palms, who produced the recording and played the fretless banjo, and Kofi Amaya, who played some of the Ghanaian percussion instruments and inspired the trip to Ghana, which plays a big role in this CD. Welcome to both of you. Kofi, let's start with you. We should mention you teach African music at Eastern Michigan University. Ghana is your home country. You and your brothers and a family friend are featured on the CD. How did it feel to be home and playing the music with them?
It just felt natural because when I was there, that's pretty much what we were doing. So one person would start playing and, you know, a minute, there would be two, five people, and then they keep building up. So Mark was able to experience that when he was there. When I was there, I was just used to it, so I wanted him to get a feel of how we used to live.
Mark, you took some recording equipment with you to Ghana. Were you just planning to catch some of the music for reference later, or did you have a CD in mind from the start?
Well, I didn't really have a CD in mind. I had one of those little Pro Tools M boxes, a couple of microphones, and I'm always trying to dig further into traditional music, so I knew that there was a relationship to the banjo in Africa, and I thought, well, gee, I'll just bring these microphones and see what I can collect.
Now, you let these recordings sit on the shelf for a while, and then you headed to New Orleans. Why New Orleans to do a mix for the CD?
Well, I've always felt that there's a strong connection with Africa and New Orleans and Louisiana with Zydeco music and jazz. And I've always wanted Kofi to get down to New Orleans and experience the music. I wanted them to experience his music. And so I had some recording time in the studio. My daughter lives in New Orleans. Natalie's a singer-songwriter, and I told her, gee, do you think we could come down there and grab some New Orleans musicians? And she said, okay, Dad, what do you need? I said, oh, a couple of horn players. And so she grabbed some local guys, and we just really did. We brought that New Orleans element into the music right on the spot in the studio. So it was a bit of a risk, but it really worked out.
Now, you brought in Matt Calloway of Detroit for guitar as well. So you've got that Ghanaian, Nolans, Motor City mix. What did all those parts add up to you?
Oh, well, that's the thing that I was really hoping for, was that connection with Detroit, with Michigan jazz, as well as New Orleans jazz. And Matt, you know, he graduated from Wayne State University. He's very accomplished. He's played in my Cajun Zydeco band, and so I know the kind of talent and versatility he has. Hey, he's young, and he said, sure, you know, I'll take it on. So we brought him along.
I want to talk about the instruments just a little bit. Kofi, let's start with you. Tell me a little bit about the instrument you play. It's an ancient mallet-based instrument. What's it called, and what makes it unique?
The instrument is called djel, and it's from Ghana, specifically the northern part of Ghana. And it's played by a few groups of people, and I've actually come across two, the Sisala and also the Dagara people, even though they share the same, you know, they almost like the same instrument, but sometimes different tuning. And it's made from a frame, you know, like a wooden frame, and on top of it are 15 keys, and each of these notes are tuned to a gourd underneath it. And I'm going to show you. It's tuned from high to low. And the lower key has a bigger gourd, and the highest pitch has a smaller gourd.
Right. There's a unique buzz to this instrument, though, that I don't think people are accustomed to hearing.
Yeah, that is the most unique thing about this instrument. And some people are still not used to it. So we always try to explain why we did that, because it was intentionally done. On the gourd, there are three holes cut on it. And traditionally, it's covered with a spider's egg sack case. I mean, I know it sounds a little yucky, but I started using a different paper from a UPS because it's similar to that. I just, you know, rip it from the UPS envelope and I cover it with it. And what happened is when you strike the key, the air travels to the gourd and it wants to come out. So it pushes the white paper that, is on the gourd, and it creates the buzzing effect.
So what's the reason for the buzz? I mean, why do you want that effect?
We want it because we believe when it vibrates or when it buzzes, it causes some sort of vibration. And traditionally, we believe that there is water in our body, and sometimes it balances that, and it creates healing to the body. And I know people have similar beliefs here, because you sit on massage chairs and you get vibrating, you know, all that vibrating
exactly.
effect.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So most of African instruments have some sort of, even the drums, either they'll have a snare on it to create a, you know, buzzing, or the xylophones will have something like this to create the vibe, you know. So it's very, to the African people, it means a lot.
Mark, I wanted to talk about your fretless banjo. Mm-hmm. I think most people are familiar with a fretted banjo, but you don't. This instrument is quite a bit different than others I've seen. What's the history with it, and why did you decide to take that with you on your trip to Ghana?
Well, I've always enjoyed playing the banjo, and I like to play this mountain clawhammer style. And I learned about the origin of that really was from African Americans, slaves that brought over banjos made with gourds. And so you get this. You get kind of a nice percussive sound, and you have to slide into your notes. And I think it's really expressive. So I just took this as an opportunity to play this instrument and go to the origin of the instrument.
Well, let's hear how they sound together, the djel and the fretless banjo.
Yes, oh, 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 yes, oh enele coco, enele coco, enele coco, oh oh, enele coco, enele coco, enele coco, enele coco, oh oh, enele coco.
Payday is the title track of the CD, and the group is called L'Afrique. And we've been talking to Mark Palms and Kofi Amaya. And thank you very much for coming in, guys. Appreciate you bringing your instruments in as well.
Oh, thanks, Lester.
Still to come, we'll find out about the H-4 visa and why it's troubling to many families coming to the U.S. Then we'll talk with a former state representative challenging Republican Congressman Tim Walberg for his seat come November. That's in 15 minutes. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham, sitting in for Cynthia Canty. Governor Rick Snyder has said during State of the State addresses and other forums that Michigan needs to embrace immigrants. He says immigrants are good for the economy. They can bring entrepreneurial spirit to the state. And one way the U.S. encourages highly trained workers to come to the country is through the H-1B visa. That visa allows U.S. employers to hire these high-skilled workers from abroad. However, their spouses are usually given an H-4 visa, which means they can live here, but they are not allowed to get a job.
My name is Marta Fenu. I'm 41 years old, and I'm from Italy. I'm married to an Italian, and I have three kids, two boys and a girl. My husband was offered a job in Grand Rapids, Michigan. He's an engineer, and he works in the automotive industry. My husband's visa status is a H-1B, which is a visa for highly skilled professional. And the visa attached to his visa, which is for spouses and kids, is the H-4. So his visa allows him to work, while my visa is just doesn't allow me to work. It's a huge limitation to the quality of my life and the quality of this experience, I would say. I feel it has a big limitation to my freedom, and somehow it also impacts my identity. Not only I can't work, but with the H-4, you don't have a social security number. So without that, you know, besides not working, there are many things that I can't actually do on my own. And it is very, very hard to adjust to this loss of independency. I have a 4-year degree in communication science, meaning communication strategies, marketing, advertising, all of that. I had my own digital advertising company. It's really hard. I came here as a career professional, and I lost basically all of that. So with time, you know, you kind of lose your self-confidence. You know, I feel like my life is here. I belong to this community. We belong to this community as a family. We engage, we do volunteering, but the inability to work keeps me left out. You know, this visa has a nickname that is the Depression Visa. And it's for a reason, because the fact that you are forced to be home without any ability to, you know, change this reality. It's really, really hard on especially wives, because, I mean, it's basically a problem that concerns women. It's mostly women that travel with H-4 visas and their kids.
Marta Fenu, who holds an H-4 visa. Joining us now is Susan M., an immigration attorney from Grand Rapids who represents Marta Fenu. So I want to make sure I understand a little bit more about this. If many of these spouses who hold H-4 visas are also skilled, why didn't they secure an H-1B like their spouse did?
It's a good question, Lester. They could, but the issue is that you have to find a qualifying employer sponsor, a U.S. employer sponsor, to offer that employment. Sometimes it doesn't happen because of timing. For instance, in Marta's case, without revealing client confidentiality, of course, it was the company's timeline was, we need him here ASAP, critically, and oftentimes it just doesn't work out magically for the spouse to obtain that necessary employer sponsorship and job offer in time to come over and accompany the spouse, the H-1B, that is. And, you know, often the H-4 is responsible for watching the dependent children, and so the timing just doesn't work out. In Marta's case, you know, she's a proven entrepreneur abroad. She is someone that very likely could start a business here and create U.S. jobs either directly or indirectly, Lester, and it's just a shame that someone like her who has that entrepreneurial spirit and is a proven entrepreneur abroad can't even seek to create her own business and direct and develop that business, create jobs here in the U.S. on the H-4 status.
Once they're here in the U.S., can these spouses who hold the H-4 visa, the one that doesn't allow them to work, can they continue to apply for the H-1B, continue to look for a U.S. company to sponsor them?
Certainly, they could. The biggest obstacle that we see with the H-1B, Lester, is even for the Googles of the world and the Facebooks of the world who want to sponsor their highly skilled H-1B IT workers, professional workers. It's a race and a ridiculous race every single year because we are capped out at 65,000 H-1Bs per year with another 20,000 available for foreign nationals that hold U.S. master's degrees. And essentially what happens, Lester, this is what happened to us last year, the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Service, the USCIS, that's the agency that accepts work visa petitions and most immigration benefit applications, well, they ran out in the first 5 days that they became available. In fact, it would have really technically been the first day they became available, April 1, but for the fact that USCIS has a policy of keeping the period open to 5 business days to accept these cap petitions. They're gone in an instant, and that's why we have so many employers clamoring for a raise in the H-1B cap. So it's not even that the Martas of the world can't get in. It's the Googles, the Facebook, folks in West Michigan, employers in West Michigan and in Michigan running out of the ability to be able to keep H-1B workers or to even have a shot at sponsoring an H-1B worker.
So huge demand, it sounds like. So these couples, some of them aren't aware of the consequences. Some of them are, but don't fully realize what's going to be happening when they get there, right?
Absolutely, Lester. I can think of several instances in my own client base where the H-4, if they were fortunate enough to get that counsel in the beginning and they understand the limitations of the H-4 category, it's not until they get here and they're living here and they may be here for that first year, second year, third year, up to the 6-year maximum, that they realize this is life-changing for me. In my home country, I used to be able to work whether for myself, maybe as a consultant, maybe to create a business, or for someone else on a part-time or full-time basis, and I'm really unhappy. And the unhappiness and the negative consequences, of course, is not limited just to that H-4, but extends to the H-1B worker, that highly valued professional that was brought over here by a U.S. employer. And we have seen in our own practice, I certainly know what happens with my colleagues' practices nationwide, the H-1B choosing to leave the country, go back to the home country because of that unhappiness.
There are, of course, concerns that every immigrant who comes to Michigan might be taking a job from somebody who lives here. Now, I understand the holders of these H-1B visas have special skills, but the H-4 visa holders might not. With the unemployment rate in the state so high, you can understand their concerns. How valid is it that these H-4 visa holders, if they were allowed to get jobs, might take a job away from a Michigander?
Certainly. That's a really good question, Lester. And it's certainly a valid concern, right, especially in Michigan. And I can't
I can't sit here and say that every single H-4 is, you know, highly qualified or more highly qualified than a U.S. worker to fill a particular position. But what I can say, Lester, is we need jobs here in Michigan. And whether they're created by U.S. homegrown and raised folks or whether they are created by foreign nationals, so many. And here in Michigan, I think we have a 33% rate of new tech startups started by foreign nationals. That's huge. I mean, we need that innovation. We need that job creation. And so I think one of the strongest arguments with regard to looking at the ability of H-4s to be able to have some access to employment authorization are the entrepreneurial folks like Amarta.
Congress is considering immigration reform. Is the H-4 visa situation, the inability for these workers to get work, included in the discussion?
It is. It is, at least with the Senate bill. We have some things that are stalled in the House right now, and we're really hoping that the House will move forward in 2014, that they'll look at this critical issue of immigration. Senate bill, Lester, did have a provision in there with regard to H-4 spouses, certain H-4 spouses being eligible for work authorization, and the limitation in that Senate bill was that this would only be available if in the foreign national's home country, U.S. spouses of U.S. citizens were offered the reciprocal benefit.
We've been talking about the H-4 visa, which does not allow spouses of holders of H-1B visas to get a job. We've been talking with Susan M. She's an immigration attorney in Grand Rapids. Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you, Lester.
One of the congressional races that will be watched closely this year is in Michigan's 7th Congressional District, a seat currently held by Republican Tim Walberg. Walberg was first elected to Congress in 2006. In 2008, he lost to Democrat Mark Schauer. In 2010, Walberg ran again, beating Schauer. Walberg has held the seat since and is a Tea Party favorite. Walberg's challenger this year is Democrat Pam Burns, a former state representative. I recently sat down with Burns and started by asking what issues are important to her.
I think the biggest issue is creation of jobs. You can look at it in different mechanisms, but it's about creating good paying jobs to build up and reinvigorate our middle class.
I hate labels, but at the same time, we like to have things categorized. So are you a liberal? Are you a moderate? How do you describe yourself?
I would describe myself as a person who's progressive and moves things forward.
Progressive is kind of a key word there.
Well, progressive in the sense that you're making progress. So, and there's people who I would see that as being opposed to reactionary. So I have a track record of working on projects, getting things done. I'm known as a no-nonsense person. Some people have said, Pam, D.C. needs you. So, you know, that's one of the major reasons I'm running.
Recently, you came out in favor of increasing the minimum wage, which is something that Mark Schauer has been campaigning on.
Yep.
Why is that important? And I assume that that doesn't make you friends with the Chamber of Commerce folks.
Well, probably not. But on the other hand, you know, Chamber of Commerce people also understand that I support infrastructure. So, and that's very business-friendly policy to have, is supporting our infrastructure. But as far as the minimum wage is concerned, is that there are too many people living in poverty. And just building up just the basic level of income just to meet necessities, I think, is essential.
There is the downside of that. That is, you run the risk of inflation and prices increasing for everyone because of increasing the minimum wage. We haven't seen an increase in the minimum wage. However, Michigan itself is a little above the federal minimum wage. Where do you strike the balance?
Well, people have to have enough income so they can go buy things. And I really don't think that the studies show that there's been an increase in the cost of products just because the minimum wage has been increased.
Let's talk about healthcare just a little bit, because Representative Walberg has repeatedly voted to kill the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare. Many Democrats running for Congress are avoiding that issue because there's a lot of controversy around it. It's not popular in some circles. What's your position on the Affordable Care Act?
I think there is room for improvement, that we really have to adjust the regulations that are called for there, but we need to be moving that forward. I think to repeal it puts you back where you're back to the position where insurance companies were controlling pre-existing conditions, children weren't covered, women were paying more for insurance, and we don't need to go back there. So we need, again, as I say, move forward, find the areas that have to be addressed, and then we correct them. That happens, I think, with a lot of major pieces of legislation.
You were a member of the Michigan legislature in the House of Representatives. You talk about reaching across the aisle, working with others, but we don't see much of that in Washington. And even some of the most well-meaning folks who go to Washington saying, I want to find compromise, find that there's no room for their kind of politics. So what makes you hopeful that if you get to Washington, you can make anything happen?
Yeah, but it can happen. And I think you saw that when people came together to start government up again after we had shut it down, although Congressman Wahlberg voted against me starting the government, that there are opportunities to do that. And I think just because somebody says it can't be done, I don't accept that.
Clearly, you believe you can do a better job than Tim Wahlberg representing the people of the 7th Congressional District, or you wouldn't be running. Yeah. What do you think you'd do differently than Representative Wahlberg?
Well, I think the congressman has a record, and this even dates back when he was in the state house, of voting no and basically just standing his ground. And I think he did that when he voted to shut down government. He said he has to stand his ground. I don't find that to be productive. I think it's costly, and it's not what the people want.
Much of your district is conservative. There are a lot of Tea Party activists in your district, in the 7th District. They like Tim Wahlberg. How much of a problem is that going to be for you? You're coming at this, as you said, with progressive ideas and a progressive notion. You're pro-choice. You're for expanding women's rights.
But I'm common sense. I'm about getting the job done. I think if you looked at the district that I ran in when I was in the House legislature, it was very much a similar district.
That was Western Washtenaw
County. Western
Washtenaw
County. The Dem base was less than 50%. I think it was like 47%, which matches the numbers for the 7th Congressional District. Many of the independent and moderate Republicans liked me, and they reelected me by an overwhelming majority of over 60% of the vote. And I believe that my kind of no-nonsense, let's get the job done, let's move this country forward, let's make government work for the people.
I was talking to one of the pundits recently, and they kind of felt like you had to be nuts to run for Congress right now. What's driving you? What's the motivation here?
Well, you know, for the last couple of years, I was working in China. So I got a whole different perspective of Michigan and the United States. And we have a lot of good product here. We've got a lot of good quality workers, and I don't think we're utilizing them properly. I don't think we're training our kids well enough to compete in the global economy. And there's so much opportunity here. I just want to make sure that's being done.
So we're going to assume that the U.S. House is going to be in Republican hands with the majority next term. You're going to have to work with Boehner or somebody like Boehner.
I'm from Cincinnati, so I can work with John Boehner. But I don't accept your assumption that it's going to be a Republican, continue to be a Republican majority. Hopefully, there are going to be other candidates like me out there, and we're going to make a change. And I think that's what the country is saying. They want a change.
So you're an optimist, too, it sounds like.
Of course.
What do you want people to know about this race and about your candidacy, above all else?
Well, basically, I'm one of them. You know, I'm a mom. I'm a grandma. I've got three grandsons, because we have an infant grandson out in Washington. I have two grandsons here in Michigan. And I work for a living. I ran my own law practice, so I've been a small business person. My husband's run his own business for 30-plus years. So we've been there. You know, I did a lot of divorce work. I've worked with single moms. I've worked with domestic violence. And I've been there. I've experienced that. I ran my own business. I had my own job, and I wasn't always on the public dole.
What part of your past do you think makes you most qualified to be a member of Congress for Michigan?
You know, I had strong family values. And again, I see that as being key. And also seeing that when I was over in China, the family values are very strong there. And we need to be reinvigorating those family values. And that's what grandmas want. They want to see their grandkids go on and get a good job. They want to have a training. And so I think I had those core values from my parents. You know, my mom, although she stayed at home, had a college education. She had her own radio program. You know, way back in the late 30s, something like that. So, you know, she was kind of a pioneer herself. And you know, my dad was a World War II veteran. Just kind of middle class America. That's who I am.
Pam Burns, former Democratic State Representative running against Republican Congressman Tim Wahlberg in Michigan's 7th Congressional District. Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Stateside was engineered today by Bob Scon. Contributors are Allie Billings, Emily Fox, and Mercedes Mejia. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. And, of course, before we end the show today, a big shout-out to Michigan State University winning the 100th Rose Bowl yesterday, beating Stanford 24-20. You won't hear me say this often, but go green. And for Cynthia Canty, I'm Lester Graham. Cindy will be back on Monday.